I had the opportunity to meet primarily through our First Things First class some time ago. Got to know them a little bit. Over time, had an opportunity to talk with John a few more times, and eventually he came to my office and he said, I need to tell you my story. And I said, well, I need to hear your story. And from that time, he has had opportunities to share parts of his story with different groups within our congregation. And it has at times been, I think he's been a little tentative about that, perhaps. And the beautiful thing is that each time he tells his story, those of us who hear it are encouraged in our faith. And he is encouraged because we love him and accept him in spite of his story, maybe because of his story. John, come and share it with us.
Man, it's a lot more comfortable in the back row, I think, than it is up here. I made some notes, and not because I don't know my story, because I want to try to keep on track with time. And with respect to that, I got a little stopwatch I'm going to take out of my back pocket. It's a blessing and a privilege to be up here and share my story with you. And it's my story is a dark one, and I want to tell you that up front. But I've got to tell it honestly and just how it happened in order to give that glory to God that He deserves. I can't water it down. So if I go back some 45 years, lost in separation from God, my story started 8 years old in El Paso, Texas, where my dad got back from Vietnam after three tours full of anger and hate, and took it out on me as an eight-year-old boy. He beat me very violently and without mercy. I knew that if I begged for mercy, that it would be worse, but I couldn't help but beg for mercy. You can be in so much pain that you can't help that. Consequently, at a young age, I turned to drugs, and I turned to martial arts. Those two things would kind of intertwine through the years and through the rest of my life, and that's why I tell you those two parts of that story. By the time I was 16 or so, I was lost in drug trafficking. I was bouncing back and forth across the Mexican border by the time I was 17 years old. Had a Corvette and a motorcycle, and I was pulled toward that outlaw motorcycle world. By the time I was 18 years old, I took my first arrest. I got arrested for drug trafficking and a concealed weapon. And I got out of that. I didn't do any jail time because we were able to pay a lawyer, and through that lawyer, pay off the district attorney. I learned from that. There were no consequences to my behavior. And people were dirty at the bottom. They were dirty at the top. Everybody could be bought. And I was the only one in charge of my destiny, or so I thought. So I'm going to fast forward through a few years here. I had some successes and failures. I actually graduated from college, paid for that through the distribution of narcotics. There was nobody there to help me. Moral compass spinning out of control all those years, never pointed to a true north. At the low point in my life, I guess you'd call it the high point in my criminal career, I joined a group called the Bandidos Motorcycle Gang. For those of you not familiar with that organization, that's the same gang that was responsible for what happened down at Twin Peaks in Waco some 3-4 months back, where 9 people died. A real tragedy. Same organization. When I got into that organization, I met a man by the name of J.W. Rock. J.W. Rock was a national, very powerful man within that organization. He was a nonviolent man, but he had a Ph.D. in crime, and I was drawn to him. He was old enough to be my dad. He was a 35-year bandito, and I came to love him like a father. I really did. I had many positions within that organization. I was a secretary, a sergeant at arms, a vice president of the infamous Waco chapter at the time. But where I excelled and did best, I think, was a sergeant-at-arms, an enforcer, and bodyguard for J.W. Rock. What an enforcer was an individual that enforced the will of the club on both my brothers as well as citizens at the direction of my boss or whoever my boss was at that time. JW traveled all over the world. The Bandidos at that time were 34, 35 countries, all through Scandinavia, Norway, Finland, Australia, Bangkok, South America, North America, two provinces in Canada. We were at war with the Hells Angels in Europe and in Canada. Anti-tank rockets, grenades, IEDs, you name it. It was pretty bad stuff. We were protected under the Constitution here, not listed as terrorists within the United States, but certainly in those other areas we were. However, in the state of Texas, the Bandidos are considered a Tier 2 threat. And the only thing that would be worse, something like ISIS, would be a Tier 2 threat or a Tier 1 threat. I've read the criteria for that, and the Bandidos certainly fit that criteria. Everything we did at my level of participation within the Bandidos was paramilitary. I mean, we executed with discipline and sophistication. We ruled by fear and intimidation with an extreme willingness to do violence. I fell deeper and deeper into that life over the years. My drug abuse when I started that club was recreational. If there's and I'll call it a club sometimes because I'd beat into my head literally over the years. It's a gang, not a club, but I still have a hard time getting rid of that term. Over the years, recreational drug abuse at first, or if there's such a thing, it was a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week ordeal that I was involved with. I mean, we were all over the place, and guarding JW took me all over the country and further. By the time I was in that club, I guess a year and a half, I had probably a $1,200, $1,300 a week methamphetamine habit. I mean, I was out there, and I was a dangerous man. I had completely got lost into that world. I'm going to kind of fast forward here in the interest to get through this in a timely manner. So thank you, John. So I guess that if I could quickly talk about the crime, because I want to tell you what a dark place I was in, the crime the Bandidos are associated with. Importation of narcotics was number one. Methamphetamine, marijuana out of Mexico. We dealt directly with cartels. I-35, you're right on the corridor here. There's cartel up and down this highway every week, all the way to the Canadian border. Heroin out of Afghanistan, up through the ports of Houston. Of course, human trafficking, prostitution. You name it, if it's a crime, they're into it. In my specific goal, we all had a job within the organization, whatever that may be. Mine was collecting money for people who owed us money, whether that be for drugs or loan sharking or whatnot, and, of course, being a bodyguard. That took me all over the country. At the time, we were having, life expectancy at my level was probably 5 years. I didn't think I'd live much long over 5 years. We were just on the edge. In fact, Mindy used to get tired. I'll never forget calling home, and she said, "I'm sick and tired of you calling home saying you almost died again today." It was happening so often that I got a nickname, Teflon, Teflon John, and that was after the Teflon Don, John Gotti in New York, if you remember that guy, because it seemed like I couldn't be killed. And I began to believe that, if you're lost in drug abuse like I was and constant exposure to danger, you can get brainwashed in a way, and that's exactly what happened. The low point, one of the low points of my life happened in late 2004. I left JW Rock in Houston, Texas, at a funeral. And at that time, we were having a funeral every week. I mean, I buried some 45 or more of my brothers while I was in the club. We were having people die every week for one reason or the other. I left JW at a funeral, Bandito named Yankee Frank in Houston. And I passed him off to another Bandido to bodyguard him, a man named Corky, a real evil guy. He tried to kill me about a year later. He's dead now. And I left him with Corky. I got back to Central Texas here, and I got the phone call that JW had been murdered. In fact, assassinated in his sleep, one in the head, two in the chest, and one in the buttocks as a show of disrespect. Man, it killed me. I thought I was the toughest guy in the world, and I fell apart. I fell to the ground. I was in a fetal position. Mindy was taking care of me. I thought I should have been there. I should be dead. I want to kill everybody. All these emotions were going through me. The anger, the hate, it brought me to the darkest place I'd ever been. And Mindy fortunately took care of me, and she's got a testimony herself. She's a victim of my actions and my decisions over the years, and she'll have to tell you about that sometime, but thank God for her. I wouldn't be alive if it wasn't for her. Why she stayed with me? Whew, man, that's anybody's guess. She should have left me 1,000 times. She could probably use some couch time with a psychologist for not doing that. But if she was standing up here right now, and I've heard her say it so many times, and you asked her, she would simply use these words, so I think I could speak for you, because I love them so much. And I've heard her say it so many times over and over again. Well, when I picked myself up, that began about a year, my last year in the Bandidos, of spinning completely out of control. I mean, I was such a dangerous guy. I remember looking people in the eyes, looking police officers in the eyes, and said, I'm ready to die right now. Are you? I don't fear God, I don't fear the law, and I don't fear any man. And I meant it, and I had that 1,000-yard stare. Phil, you've probably seen that before in people. I was at a real low point. I went through about a year of that, and I wanted out so bad. I didn't know if whether that came in death or whatever. I just wanted out. And they knew that, and I was in a very dangerous position. My whole life I carried with me this weird thing that I didn't like to see innocent people hurt. And I don't know if that came from martial arts or my abuse as a child, but I just couldn't, and that put me in danger over and over and over again in the Bandidos and in conflict with that organization. So they called me into a meeting after my participation was very poor. They tried to discipline me over and over again. I was so far out there, they called me into a meeting, and I knew there was a good chance that I wasn't going to walk out of that room. And Mindy recognized the signs of something really being wrong. And the first sign was me putting on a bulletproof vest and carrying more than one gun with me. When I got dressed in that manner, there was something really wrong, and I was in danger. And, of course, I was cleaning my guns. Sometimes I carry three, one here, and one down by my ankle. And everything I put on was purposely put on to go into combat, if you will. And she recognized that. She came up to me and said, what's wrong? And, of course, I didn't tell her. I never told her. And I said, I got to go. I said, if anybody comes here but me, don't open the door and call 911. And that's all I said. And I left. And can you imagine, I mean, leaving your wife that way in the fear that she went through? Now, my house, I mean, I knew she was fairly safe from the standpoint. I had 360-degree surveillance. We had motion detectors in the yard. There was a steel bar that came across a steel door that was secured with I-beams on both sides. I was constantly had surveillance from the federal authorities. Law enforcement knew me, local, state, they all knew me. And we'd get investigated, you know, at least a couple times a year. In fact, the feds used to sometimes park in the driveway. Mindy would come get me and say they're in the driveway again. I'd walk out with a coffee cup and they'd take off. And I think it was just an intimidation thing. But the protection I had was both from them as well as from my brothers, which was the real danger. All cops could do is beat you up and put you in jail. That was nothing compared to what my brothers would do to me. That's where it always came from, within. I went to that meeting, and I took my weapon out and said simply two words, I quit. They said, you can't quit, we'll kill you. And I backed out of that room. That began a couple of 3 months of them hunting me very heavily. I got caught off guard. That was November 17th. Of 05. And the reason I know that date so well is it's tattooed on my shoulder. Is that okay to show that? There's a gang tattoo on my shoulder, and it's tattooed across my shoulder, that out date. So I've got that fairly well memorized, and that's been hidden underneath this shirt for a long time. Anyway, they caught up with me Christmas Eve of 05. I got caught off guard about three blocks from my house, and we got in a gunfight. We exchanged fire, and I got ready to re-engage, and I thought immediately, my family, are they at my house? And I disengaged, got out, got to the house, and they weren't there. The typical method of hit and run, you know, is what they did. They left, and I told Mindy, you got to get out of town. And she did. She got the kids and left. I stayed there all night waiting for them to come back with the door unlocked. One of the longest nights of my life, and not one night, or 1 second of that night, did I think about our Christ Jesus? You know, the day that we celebrate his birth, I never thought about him, not for a second. I had no God or Christ in my life for all these years. I knew God existed. I just was in conflict with him. I wasn't on his team, if that makes sense. I mean, I was about as opposite as you can get, I think. Well, they didn't come back. They tried to kill me again about a month and a half later. This time I was prepared. No shots were fired. And right after that, the club got RICO'd. And what that is federal racketeering charges. It's a charge they use for the mafia and organized crime for actions along the northern border in the country. They got RICO'd for, I think it was murder, racketeering, kidnapping, maybe drug trafficking. And a bunch of them consequently went to jail, including the president of the Bandidos at that time. That took a lot of pressure. There was a lot of federal pressure and law enforcement pressure, and that actually kept me safe. The other thing that kept me safe, of course, was me, my gun. I was a very dangerous guy, and I said I'd kill everybody, and I meant it. I had the opportunity, actually, when they came in on me at my shop right over here off the highway, and I had the drawdown on them, and people asked me, why didn't you kill them? And I said, because I loved them. And I know that's strange and not normal, but that's why I didn't, because I loved them. So at that point, I started to heal. And I healed because I think of the possibility of forgiveness. And I don't mean forgiveness from God, but forgiveness from Mindy and my family. That softened my heart. And then I decided I wanted to push away that drug addiction. And I did. I got off the drugs. And then I decided I'm going to have to work. I'm going to have to get a real job. I didn't think I'd ever have to work again. I mean, everything we did, we got our money from what we did in crime. I didn't think I'd have to work again. After about 3-4 years, I decided maybe I can be a truck driver. That's something where I could be alone. I didn't want to be around anybody. It's hard to make friends when your friends try to kill you. Well, it's true. And so I didn't want to be around anybody. And I thought I could do this, and I could be alone, and maybe that's my place. Maybe that's where I can fit. And so I went to a truck driving school. And toward the end of that course, there was and I think my heart had softened up. Maybe God saw something he could use. And there was a little black man, an old guy, and he was talking to me, and we were alone in a classroom. And we were talking about trucks, and he said, do you know Jesus? And I said, no. It kind of caught me off guard. And I said, no. And he said, well, you're gonna. He said, not only are you going to, but you're going to affect people, not just one person, but a lot of people. I said, what are you talking about? I mean, it threw me completely off. And he said, I don't talk to a lot of people about this. I don't witness. And I thought, witness? What is that, a snitch? And, you know, it just sounded off. Threw me off for a minute. I didn't know what witness was, you know. And he said, I don't witness a lot, and I don't talk to people about this, but I feel called to tell you that. He said, can I pray for you? And how do you say no? I said, sure, you know. Pray for me. And he prayed for me. And I felt this. It's kind of hard to explain. I don't know if I was having a heart attack. I don't know if I was having anxiety. Or I don't know if it was the Holy Spirit. But I began to feel a feeling. It wasn't really a burning. It was like a crushing. I really remember it in my throat. It was like an apple. I couldn't swallow. And it was over. It just overwhelmed me, this feeling. And I walked out to my truck. And I got in my truck. And for the first time since JW was murdered, I cried. And tears were just flowing out of me. It was like 45 years of pain was coming out of me. I mean, my shirt was wet. And I just started, I started praying, and I started talking to Jesus. I didn't know what to say. You know, forgive me. Help me. Come into my life. I love you. Anything I can think of. I didn't know the words, so I tried to go through the whole gamut, you know, of what I thought he wanted to hear to accept me in his grace. I drove home, and I walked in the house, and Mindy saw me, and she said, what's wrong? And I said, God's come into my life. And I didn't know what else to say. I mean, I know now he never left. I left. but that's what I said. And I began to go through this about 6 years of not knowing my place and what God's plan for me was. I didn't know how to talk to my wife about my faith. So I kind of studied in my bedroom. I read the whole Bible. I read it cover to cover. It took about a year and a half, and I thought a light was going to go off in my head, and that never happened. You know, like I was going to get some big blessing after I finished the Bible. That didn't happen. I was on the road, and I was so lonely. And by the way, I was a baby. I was such a hard man for so many years, and now my heart, God just broke it to where I was crying all the time about anything. I mean, I watch a pharmaceutical commercial where these old people are walking down the beach holding hands, and then they get their drug at the end of the commercial, and I'm like, thank God they got their drug, and I'm crying. And I'm still not fixed, by the way. I used to pray all the time, God, thank you for breaking me, but if you're ready, I'm ready to be healed. You know, and I prayed for that, and I was reading scripture one day, and it just sort of hit me that this isn't a curse. It's a blessing. It's a curse not being able to feel pain for people's pain, not being able to feel pain for when people are hurting. That was the curse. This is a blessing, and I share it with people when I hear them cry. I've shared it with people recently when I've heard them cry. And I love that. And cry on my shoulder, I'll cry on yours, you know. Anyway, after about 6 years of just thinking I could worship within those four walls, there'd be no action to my faith. I thought that was okay. I felt called to belong to something, to maybe belong to a church. I'd never been in a church. And I saw Brother John at two funerals. Mindy and I saw Brother John at two funerals, and after the second one, man, I was touched to the hope in his words and how he spoke, and I asked Mindy, I said, who is this guy? And she said, well, that's Dr. John Crowder. Everybody knows him. And I said, well, does he take Blue Cross Blue Shield? Because I'd like him to be my doctor. I mean, and she said, he's not that kind of doctor. And I said, oh. And she explained to me who he was, and I said, well, where's his pajamas or his robe or whatever it is? And she said, they don't all wear that. And I said, oh, okay. And I said, well, I think I'd like to hang out with him. And she goes, you mean go to worship? I said, you know what I mean. Stop correcting me. We left, and we decided that we wanted to come to this church. And we almost did, probably 40 times. You know, Sunday would come along, and, oh, I got to shave my head, or I don't have the right clothes to go there. And finally, one weekend, we decided, this is the weekend, we're going to go. And we did. We walked in here, and we sat right back there where we still sit. And my spiritual awakening occurred. Phil walked up here and said, we're going to Honduras. And I sat back there and said, I'm going. Here I am. And Mindy said, what? And she's used to that kind of thing. Okay, baby, whatever you want to do, you know. And I can't tell you about how important it is to have action in our faith. I woke up that day, unbelievably. I mean, since then, and when I tell you this story, I try to tell it humbly, and it's hard to, and I know sometimes it may not sound humble, but please believe me, I failed miserably as a man, as a husband, as a father, as a friend, a citizen. The glory is God's. A lot of people, after they hear my testimony, and I hadn't told in a long time until I came into this church, they say, man, it's amazing what you've been able to do. Oh, no, I didn't do anything. I failed. The glory goes to God. About 3 months after that or so, we were baptized Easter Sunday, and about 3 months after that or so, we were in a small group study, and, man, I was going Tuesday night, Wednesday night, Bible study before church, small group study after church. I was calling John saying, why don't we have anything on Mondays and Fridays? I got some free time here, man, and I can't get enough of you guys. I just can't get enough. And I was talking to Mindy one day, and I said, man, do you think I'll ever tell them my story? And Mindy said, oh, no, they love us. And we love them. And I said, you're right. We can't ever tell this, you know. So we were in a small group study on a Sunday, and this horrible thing happened in Waco at Twin Peaks. And I sat there. The TV was on. There were about four or five couples in this church that were there. And I started turning red. I felt like I was lying. And I looked over at Mindy, and she said, baby, if you think it's the right time, go ahead. And so I told them, and I was so scared. I mean, I remember my hand was shaking, and I was trembling way worse than I am right now, because I thought that I might not be welcome here. But I felt a need. I couldn't lie, and I felt like I was lying by being quiet. So I told them the story over about an hour and a half, 2 hours, I don't know how long we were there. And what I found was they couldn't see anything but what was in front of them. All they could see is who I am, not who I was. And as I tell this story, I know in my heart that you guys are experiencing the same thing, that you look up here and you say, wow. Many can tell you that transformation. I mean, I was a bad man, and I installed fear in people, and I you can't see that now, and that's a miracle in itself. I think that's a miracle. I'm amazed by it. And not only did they still love me, but I think they love me more. Can I speak for you, Teresa? I think they love me more, and I was amazed by that. And every one of them hugged me. I think I made them hug me, or I asked them to hug me. I needed that. And you know, John, I think I needed that. And every one of them hugged me, and my spirit just erupted the next morning. Since then, I've got involved in jail ministry. I go down on Sundays to those broken men down there, and I get involved in jail ministry. I mean, the place, Honduras. I've told my story from Honduras to a 1,700-member church in Las Cruces, and it's God's done just amazing things. Maybe that little black guy in the truck driving school was a prophet. I don't know, but God's done amazing things in my life, and I can't tell you how much I love each and every one of you and how much love I feel back from you. And I guess that's my story. I want to thank you for listening to it, and tell you you've got my loves, you've got my loyalty, and you've got my respect, and I won't let you down.